Cultural Icons interview Sir James Wallace, art collector and arts patron. James, I think it's about 30 years since I first met you, and I recently arrived at the Auckland Art Gallery and knew you then as an art collector, and have watched the remarkable passage of your collecting and the growing breadth of your arts patronage over those 30 years. Wonderful achievement and very deservedly recognised recently. James, I thought we might just sketch in a little bit of your background. My understanding is you completed a law degree, practiced law for a little while, then went in business before the Wallace Corporation. And the interest in the visual arts began at university or shortly after?
No, it really started when I went on scholarship to Boston at 16, to a prep school there, what they call a prep school, and got exposed to opera and the museums of Boston, New York especially. Then I hiked around Europe at 17, came back here by 18, and crawled in on a lot of museums and galleries at that point. So that got me going.
It got you going then. And I think I read somewhere that you might have tried your hand yourself in the visual arts and came to the conclusion you weren't all that good at it.
To say the least. I was persuaded that I should go to do some art lessons to see how it worked and how difficult it was, really. And I did find it was difficult.
But not the same for the performing arts. I think you've been a choral singer and...
Yes, that was the one thing in the years that I was abroad especially that I could carry with me, because you just had to have your voice. And so I sang in some major choirs in New York and London, and then with Dorian Singers back here under Peter Godfrey, until I got to the point where I was too busy to go to all the rehearsals, and he chucks you out, of course, if you don't go to all these rehearsals. But that was a tremendous discipline. It was one of the best choirs in the world.
And that interest in and support of music has continued?
Yes, very much so.
Now tell me about the beginnings of this collection obsession, because collecting is an obsession. Who were you collecting and how and where? And
I started, as it happened, with a small watercolour by Tos Wollaston, which I got just after law school. The next few years were rather sporadic, because not only was I overseas quite for several years, but lack of finance meant that even when I came back, I couldn't buy much. Although the next one was a Robert Ellis, and then a... and so on. Anyway, in the days when you just had almost queued to go to an opening of a gallery, Barry Lett and so on. As finances improved, I got into regular buying of the contemporary art that I enjoyed. And eventually I filled in gaps with the artists or their dealers or along the way with auction houses. And Tos Wollaston would be a very good example. Peter McCleavy and Tos got together with me to fill in the gaps there, a deal that took me 3 years to pay off, I think. But it meant that before he died, he said I had the deepest, widest collection of his works, and I've added to it since, mainly with Peter McCleavy's help. And I've done that with a number of other artists too. But in Philip Trustum's case, for decades, I've just paid him on a regular basis, and every year we reconcile that against the works that I'm going to take into the collection.
How soon after that initial acquisition of the watercolour by Tos and the Robert Ellis and so on, did you start to develop the idea that this was not just acquiring some artworks, but it was actually going to be a collection?
I think I had it in mind quite early, but I didn't really sell it as a charitable trust until the early 90s. About 20 years ago. Till then, I just bought them for myself, but with the idea that they would become a collection that was really a diary collection, what I saw happening as we went along. Nothing has ever been sold, so it is just that, warts and all. But at least it shows everything that I thought was worth looking at from emerging artists and then trying to keep up with them as they emerged. For those decades, that's why not having culled the collection at all, which people do indulge in, it is quite big, but that's fine by me. I don't regret any of the acquisitions. A number of them, artists, of course, didn't emerge for various reasons, died or got married and went off as academics or whatever. But a good number have continued that I've kept up with as much as I can.
The diary collection is an interesting idea. I remember when we were collecting at the Auckland Art Gallery in the 80s, it seemed important to be collecting that was happening at the time, in the full knowledge that some of that would remain very relevant and some of it much less relevant. And, of course, you're collecting with the sensibility of the time in which the things are being made. The sensibilities change as well.
Yes. You have to be a bit courageous because you can't just wait till someone gets critical acclaim and is obviously established, because then they've become very expensive as well. For me, the greatest pleasure is trying to pick the emerging artist. So I do a lot of, I do every second Saturday or so, I do perhaps 20 to 30 dealer galleries. I do the academic end-of-year shows, and dealers throughout New Zealand are always in touch with me about what they think is worthwhile. And nowadays, of course, they can send up images and you can get quite a way without actually having seen the work, although I very rarely buy anything that I haven't actually seen. Mm.
I remember as an art student, a recent graduate, having feasted on the work of international artists but never seen any of it.
Yeah.
The first trip abroad, the realisation of what the actual surface was like, what the paint was like and so on, was a profound shock as well as a great excitement.
Yes.
So the photography is always a very poor substitute.
Absolutely. You get misled by the size too, not
yes.
just that. I do spend a lot of time every year seeing what's happening overseas. I take several trips and concentrate on going to reviews and retrospectives and art fairs and so on, just to keep my eye in. But because there's so much happening in New Zealand, I have restricted the collection to New Zealand artists. I'm happy for other collectors to bring in overseas artists, Chartwell and so on. But we have to have some definition to what you're doing.
Yes, now let's talk about the direction of the collection, because you're well known for your support of emerging artists, and you've mentioned that that was a focus, a strong focus in the beginning. And you've concentrated on New Zealand art. How soon did the whole process of collecting form a kind of focus? This collection is going to be about this. What did you see it as being about, and how did that change over time?
I think it just simply evolved in different directions, because part of it is commissions. I have commissioned a lot of sculpture and a certain number of paintings and so on, and some music and so on. But one of the focuses has been, in the last 20 years at least, the Art Awards. So we've just had our 20th, and that brings together a lot of art from around the country, including always some people that I've never heard of before, and the dealers have not put me in touch with before. It's a very good net for artists that are not well known. And so we buy quite a lot from the finalists of the Art Awards.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, with the winners, makes quite a good focal point for the collection.
Mm.
Next year we'll have an exhibition of the 20 winners when we finish with the Dowse, which has the last of the finalists towards Christmas. And it'll be very interesting because none of them have been exhibited since they won. The second one was Bill Hammond, for instance, before he became expensive. The first of his bird paintings, practically. I think most of them are pretty strong. Most of them have gone on to international sort of exposure too. So,
and we'll talk a bit later about your continuing support of Philip Trustam, and you've mentioned the way that relationship has been established. Have there been other artists that you have focused on that through this process of collecting and charting the emergence of contemporary art that that you have thought particularly noteworthy?
Yes, I think we have the biggest collection of a number of the senior artists, both dead and alive, and a pretty good cross-section of others. So, but it's always going to be problematical whether concentrating on someone is going to turn out to be anything more than just collecting it on that diary basis. Some of them we've built up quite a lot of their works, but they haven't necessarily fulfilled the promise we thought they'd have, or I thought they'd have.
Mm. Mm. The awards, let's talk about those briefly. 20 years, just recently, this year's annual awards. They began with a strong focus on young artists, didn't they, and emerging artists. Is that still the focus? Or because I noticed that in this year's lineup, there are one or two strongly emerged as well as emerging.
Yes.
Has the nature of the awards changed?
Not really. It's just because I don't judge. I'm not one of the judges. It's up to the judges to decide who's going to get the awards. You're right, one really quite a senior artist this year got an award, not one of the leading ones. The winner, the Paramount winner, I've never heard of, really. Well, hardly ever heard of. And the next few were not, they're not established in the way that, say, the expensive Hammonds and others are now. So the judges, say, this year had started off with about 560 applications. So they winnow it down to the physical finalists that come up to be seen in flesh, because the first lot are judged on photographs.
Right.
And they then just decide between them who's going to get the residencies and the cash prizes and so on. That's the other aspect of that's occurred over those years. We've gone from cash prizes to, at a very early stage, to overseas residencies, and now four overseas residencies and three cash prizes.
How do the residencies work?
Well, they're all really different. The Paramount winner gets 6 months at ISCP in New York, which is, everyone that's been there has found it very, well, all the residencies, they all come back and say they've had leapt forward one way or another.
Mm.
They get exposed to what's happening overseas. They get critics come in to see their work, and they get taken on field trips and so on, depending on which one it is, New York, Vermont, Headlands and San Francisco and Switzerland. But it's the same sort of pattern. They have accommodation and a studio and support systems for their work. But particularly important, they get exposed to other artists in whichever city they're in, and beyond that city too, usually.
How have you gone about the organisation of that? Because that's quite a lot of logistics. Has the trust acquired property, or do you rent property? Do you have agents in these four locations?
No. The institutions concerned, whether it's Headlands or Alterspital or whatever, they provide the facilities, and we have a contract with them. It does still take quite a lot of administration. That's why we've had to keep building up the staff of the trust, that and now the advent of the Power Homestead.
Hmm. So the trust collection now, I think I read somewhere about 5,000 objects?
Yes, well, including sculpture and some ceramics and
right.
so on, about 5,500.
Primarily painting, or
yes,
but the commissioned sculpture and what about installation art, conceptual photography?
Oh yes, quite a lot of photography, but it has to be unique. if someone else has collected, there's no need for us to collect it.
Yes,
but surprisingly enough, we have quite a few hundreds of photographs on that right. basis. Certain amount of glass, and quite a lot of ceramics. And quite a lot of sculpture, but painting, works on paper. And they're all on our Vernon system and available on our website, so anyone can go onto our website and see all 5,500 works, see the image and then the particulars about them.
Yeah, that's wonderful. That means that your collection really, in numerical strength, and let alone curatorial strength, equals or exceeds many of the public collections in this country.
Yes, but yeah, I suppose if we culled it, it wouldn't. But one of the ways we deal with that vast number is that we have about 42 or 43 loans to universities on a revolving basis, universities, hospitals, schools, and so on. And then we have the Wallace Gallery in Morrinsville and the Wallace Wing at the Dowse in Wellington. So we have, and then we lend works all the time to provincial and national city galleries. When they're curating shows, they go into our collection, see it on the website, and they say, can we have this and this and this? And we're very happy to spread the risk and help them with curate representative shows.
As the collection started to grow and the numbers crept up and up and up, you must have thought, what am I going to do with this stuff?
Yes, well, it is a problem, but partly solved by the big storage facility that was built for us at the Power Homestead.
Yes.
It helps us curating these shows and revolving them. And we keep adding loans. We're about to add two or three more big loans. And that's what we'll continue to do through the country.
The Power Homestead Initiative, of course, has made the collection much more accessible. I mean, you've been very generous with access at Rannoch, but Power has moved you into a completely different
realm. Absolutely. We were quite accessible at the old Customs House because we had a lot of room. At Queen Street, we had a little gallery, but it was not much use in that respect. But now, here we have the Power with all its galleries open 6 days a week, free to the public.
And very good attendance, as I
gather. Oh, yes. We were given the target of 15,000 for the first year and 3,500, I think, by the fifth year or something like that. And we hit 130,000 in mid-August, which was the anniversary. Had
That's
another
mad.
Seven or eight since.
And schools have been
yes.
a good part of that audience.
Been very encouraging. It's a bit like part of the program I have with the Auckland Philharmonic is bringing in busloads of people from especially poorer schools and exposing them to an orchestra or to art. So we have this lovely story about the 100,000 person who came was a girl from a poor school in South Auckland, Samoan family. She had been with a school party a few weeks before, and she brought her entire family that Sunday, and she happened to be the 100,000th. So, and that family would never have been to a normal contemporary art gallery. That's what we're finding from our surveys of the people coming. They're finding is very approachable as a house and in a park and so on.
Yes. When the Power Homestead Initiative was first conceived, was that educational mandate part of your thinking or did that just emerge?
It was definitely part of what we're given as objectives and what we wanted as objectives. We haven't been able to develop as much as we'd like yet, partly because of financial constraints. At the moment, we're really not getting much support from anywhere. The average donation is 18 cents, no, 16 cents, gone up from 11 cents, which doesn't get us very far.
That's the right trend, though.
The irony is that the Wallace Gallery in Morrinsville is about a dollar a head more than that.
Is that right?
And they'll hit 20,000 visitors within the first year.
In Morrinsville?
In Morrinsville.
Yes. I remember back in the 60s when the Rodin exhibition came to New Zealand, the biggest attendances were Eka Tuhuna, and they exceeded the population of Eka Tuhuna, but that's quite modest, I think. The Parr Homestead, is that it for now in terms of a home or vehicle for the collection, or do you have ambitions that go beyond Parr?
I would have always wanted to build a modern art museum. One of my passionate interests is architecture as well, contemporary architecture, well, architecture generally. And I don't know if it'll ever be achieved, but that's something I'd like to complement the Parr. Parr is a beautifully restored mansion of the 1870s, but it has its constraints because it has, of course, all the windows and you don't have any really big walls, especially for big contemporary art pieces. Mm. So that may happen someday. Get in a great architect to design something. I enjoy building things as well.
That'd be a wonderful project. Just recently I've been over in Melbourne and popped out to Heidi and Tarawarra, which I'd not been to before. Have you been there at all?
Yes.
It's a splendid building, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Really nice vehicle. And just about the right size, I think. So maybe that will happen one day.
Yes, yep.
James, we'll come back to the art collection and the artists, but your support of the arts is more wide-ranging, just the visual arts. They're your obvious and most well-known passion, but music, you've used Rannoch is used a lot by other arts organisations, Writers
yes.
Festival,
yep.
Auckland Theatre Company.
Yes, I have annual grants. We make annual grants to most of those institutions. And again, and for example, with music, it's a matter of supporting Bach Musica or Chamber Orchestra and so on, because they're the training centres for the people that then move on to the Auckland Philharmonia and maybe the NZSO and so on. But it also creates a wider range of programmes than is possible for a big symphony orchestra. Then the choirs. Auckland has about 64 choirs, I note, apparently, and certainly at least 8 or 10 that are very good.
Mm.
And they all need some support because hardly any of them get much from any local or central government. And so that's one of the joys of being in a position to make some grants to these people, these institutions, but also to opera singers or actors or whatever that get into overseas institutions, help them a bit on their way. And so often it has its rewards. I've just been to Bayreuth to hear Simon O'Neill singing Parsifal, and I helped him a bit in his early days, and he is just so fantastic in repaying that, in the sense that, I mean, he made all the arrangements at Bayreuth and got the tickets, which are as rare as hen's teeth and so on, and met me at the railway station, carried my bags and showed me Bayreuth and the innards of the opera house, yes. Festspiel House. And so there he is, top of, he's booked till 2018 at all the major opera houses in the world, mainly Wagnerian roles, but he remains a very modest New Zealander who repays the people that helped him, and it wasn't very much, I don't think, in those days. So that's one of the rewards of some of this is being associated with people that like that, that become successful in the different disciplines of the arts.
Yes. It's said that in smaller communities that creative talent more readily emerges than in bigger communities. It's certainly true that in this city of only a bit over a million people in a country that's a population size of one Australian state capital, that we seem to produce an extraordinary number of, well, at one level, capable, but at another level, absolutely excellent artists in the performing arts, visual arts, across the disciplines. Do you have any... I mean, we think of ourselves as this pragmatic number eight fencing wire country that produces rugby players and yachtsmen, but there's this other side to us. Do you have any explanation for that?
No, I don't, but it is a fact. We have a totally disproportionate number of famous international opera singers, for instance.
Yes.
And in the visual arts, I come back all the time from the overseas trips and go around the galleries here and think, what, how out of proportion it is to have that many dealer galleries, that many artists who are living off their art here. We've just been to Berlin to see particularly expatriates there, but it's not the lively scene it was. It's certainly, in proportion, it's not as lively as Auckland in the visual arts now. But that's what's so exciting. And such a challenge, too. That's why I can't spread beyond New Zealand in terms of collecting. It's hard enough to keep up with what's going on here.
Yes. Now, when you bought that first Toss Woolliston watercolour, one was buying Woolliston and McCann for 5 or 7 guineas.
Yes.
You mentioned some of the more expensive artists subsequent to that. A number of artists now are actually able to carve out a comfortable income for themselves. But we have all of these artists. I mean, how is it possible to sustain such a production?
I believe that we've extended the audience for these works, the buyers, particularly with the buying groups, the buying group that Warwick Brown started and all that broke off away from, well, he developed from that.
Mm.
Now, I was in that first buying group and part of the selection committee. A lot of the members just didn't like anything we bought and wouldn't necessarily hang them. But when you went to swap it, they got used to it and they said, oh, maybe we'd rather keep it. And it is just that exposure to the art.
Mm.
And if you challenge them all the time, even though their first reaction is that they don't like it, most of those people became collectors. And all the other buying groups that grew from that, a lot of them became collectors. So that's quite a different scene from when I first started collecting.
Back in the early 80s, the Queen Elizabeth II Arts Council, under the chairmanship of Hamish Keith, developed a policy for subsidising and supporting dealer galleries because they were intent upon developing a sustainable market for contemporary art. And I watched the development of that art market through that decade of the 80s. Of course, it was the period of the Longy government and when we suddenly seemed to be feeling like a nation. But it was extraordinary. And towards the end of that decade, when the stock market crash happened, the New Zealand historical art market just dropped like a lead balloon. But the contemporary art market didn't to the same extent because people like you, I suspect, sustained it. But it's amazing what's happened since then.
Yes. I think that where the people that had some funds were buying Goldies and so on in those previous decades, then their ilk now would be buying contemporary art, not Goldie.
Yes.
Most of them anyway.
Yeah. Do you know why? Why the sudden switch from the comfort of something like a Goldie to the edginess of contemporary art?
I think it just does come back to this exposure, being exposed to it and and realizing that that it's the challenge can be exciting. I think too, there's a certain degree of expectation that the value is going to keep going up, and therefore that's an investment. And that has been the case for a number of artists, or quite a few artists.
The history of art shows us that that, of course, is a completely false expectation.
Yes. Yes. In fact, McCanns in recent times have been selling for a lot less than they peaked at.
Is that so? Yes. I also have a sort of slightly uncomfortable feeling about what I would almost describe as the shopping list of social necessity, a kind of list of artists that, you need to have in your home in order to be credible socially. Yes. Is that a fair comment?
Oh, it is quite fair with quite a lot of people, I think. That's why I, even at Rannoch, I insist on hanging some pretty unknown artists all the time, mixed with the others.
Yes.
And at the Power, the exhibitions we've been curating have all had some sort of challenge. We haven't just had the pick of the collection there. We opened with a cross-section that included some of the more important paintings, but on the whole we're just curating the recent acquisitions and things like that.
How do you best guess fashion and the whim of taste, or don't you bother?
I don't bother. It doesn't make any difference to me because, well, firstly, because we don't sell anything, so it doesn't matter if it's gone up in value or not.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter to me whether people say, oh, that's a shotgun approach to it all. I'm comfortable with what I'm doing.
Yes. The secondary market, that must be a bit of a gauge.
It's very, very interesting because it is erratic.
Yes.
But again, as opposed to those earlier decades, we have a lot of happening on the secondary market. Those several auction houses and having regular sales with major catalogues.
Now, the collectors of your generation, is there another younger generation of collectors coming through?
I think you're getting, yes, a better response from some younger collectors in terms of, but more in terms of having the right art in their house for their friends and visitors. I don't know how many are doing anything altruistic. In fact, I don't know of anyone that's sort of collecting because they're going to give the collection to the nation or to anything else.
Let's talk about those collections because there have been a number, not a huge number, but a significant number, of fine collections formed around the country. In Wellington, Les Paris, the Gibbs collection, the Chartwell collection, I mean, you know them all. What's the future of these collections? Because I ask that question knowing that the public institutions themselves have been collecting as well, so it's not as though there's a great vacuum and need to be filled there. What do you see as the future of the private collections?
In the case of Alan Gibbs's farm, it's just a magnificent facility where he gets commissions, major international sculptors, as you know. And I'm sure that although it's limited access at this stage, that it will remain as a... He's not going to sell it off. And Chartwell, of course, is there. Hamilton missed out because they were so stupid, but Auckland Gallery has the Chartwell really under its wing. So it's a national asset. And I believe that a number of other private collectors will inevitably give quite a lot of their more important works to the various public galleries. Have been doing so and will continue to do so. I don't know that anyone is thinking of setting up any gallery in the way we've done with the PA. That's quite a challenge to actually set up the facility. Luckily, we've done that in a sense with the Auckland City with a 30-year lease. But it would be great if there were a few more private institutions like that open to the public.
Do you think there's an argument for establishing a museum or gallery of contemporary art that might well draw upon those collections?
Yes. I would hope that we would end up with a major art museum down on the waterfront, the Wynyard Quarter or something, that's complementary to the City Gallery.
Yes.
Is an iconic building, which is always part of the whole thing anyway.
Yes.
And which will concentrate on the contemporary side. There are numerous examples of that. As you know, Brisbane and other cities of similar size have done it.
Yes.
So you have the traditional museum and you have the modern museum working together. Auckland deserves that down on the waterfront.
Exactly.
If, as it appears, the Auckland Theatre Company is going to build with the down there, then with the ASB, then that's exactly where it should be an opera house and a modern art museum.
Is anybody driving such an idea?
There are some murmurs.
Some murmurs. Oh. You involved in the murmur?
Yes. Well, pushing some ideas, yes.
James, let's talk about patronage, because you've made an observation at the time of your investiture and elsewhere that closely coincides with my own observations, and that is that the generation of collectors that we've just talked about was also the generation of patrons. I'm not sure I see your generation being followed. Would that be fair?
Absolutely fair. It's a great concern for those of us that are continue to support these institutions, but look behind us and see little of note coming to replace us. I think it's absolutely important that if you have quite a bit of wealth that you make it accessible to the community or the country supporting, well, it might be health or education, but in my case, the arts. You're really, people should feel obliged to do that rather than just becoming wealthy and enjoying everything themselves, not giving anything back. It's certainly vital for a lot of these institutions that they do have this private patronage. It just cannot exist on central or local government funding and box office or other support. The sad thing is that I think this lot that's following us in terms of age, they're really, a lot of them are very wealthy. They're lawyers and businessmen and that have earning vast sums of money. And there are some obscene salaries for CEOs and others. And yet you don't see that coming into anything in particular, at least on the arts side. I mean, some of them channeled some of their company funds into things, but that's not the same as private patronage.
Mm. Is this happening abroad too? I mean, the United States, its amazing cultural achievement is built upon private patronage.
Yep.
Is there a waning there as well?
I think yes, but that's partly because of the present economic situation there. I don't think it is a cultural thing in the terms of environment. That has been a fantastic example of how private sponsorship has made lots of institutions viable. It was always argued that that's because they had such a great tax break. But now we have total tax break here. You can donate, you can write off your entire donation against your tax. So if you're donating to a charitable organisation, and all these cultural institutions are charitable. So no longer can we argue that's the problem. And yet it's made very little difference.
So it's an attitudinal one.
Yes, I think so.
I mean, to an old curmudgeonous fellow like me, it seems that we now live in a time of greed. Could that be something to do with it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's incredible how selfish so many people seem to be, how self-centered and around their own lifestyle and their own assets, their yachts or their whatever.
It says something about the lifestyle that people are expecting too, doesn't it? Because we're also living in a period where the halcyon days of public funding are now, well, they're not hopefully going to depart entirely, but they're diminishing. Yeah. And that means that in order to sustain the level, let alone grow it, that we've achieved, the funding is going to have to come from somewhere else.
Yes.
And you've indicated that in the arts, users pays does not do it. That's absolutely true. So does that mean that the people who are unwilling to, who have the means and are unwilling to support those important things that create a civilised environment, don't want a civilised environment?
I just think there's a lack of recognition that if these cultural institutions in particular shrivel, their environment, the cities they live in or the country they live in, will be that much poorer, and they'll be that much poorer because they simply will not have the depth of music and theatre and visual arts and so on. Because it is a vital ingredient to proper, a decent life that you have all of that side, not just the physical side, not just the sports and yachting and all the rest of it.
Do you think that electronic media and the internet might have a part to play in all of this? I have the feeling that authenticity, originality, the confrontation with the actual object or experience, which is so important a part of theatre or music or the visual arts, is being replaced by a kind of second-hand experience. I mean, on one level, it's all the computer games and so on,
yep.
but there is so much available to everybody on the internet and through all these electronic media that one wonders whether the need for the authentic, the respect for the authentic, the enjoyment of the authentic is no longer as strong as it was.
I think you're right, but I think that's what's so dangerous, because the second-hand experience is never going to be as good. It goes back to your reference to going and finally seeing art overseas for the first time. It's so totally different from seeing it in a book. And that goes for everything. But Twitter and all the rest of it all drives me mad. No one writes a decent letter anywhere to anyone. And I think we're going to have some really great problems in sustaining the kind of cultural, intellectual life that makes a community worthwhile if they continue to just get diverted by the equivalent of your computer games or whatever.
A period in art that fascinates me is the 1920s and into the 30s, and in particular I have always been greatly fascinated by de Staël, the Dutch modernist movement.
Yes.
And there, of course, the propagandists for de Staël envisaged a future where there would be no sort of transportable art. Art would be everywhere, from town planning and buildings.
Yeah.
You would live in it, and there would be no need for easel painting or any of that kind. Is it possible that we're heading into a period when, because they were proved to be wrong,
yes.
People still wanted to have easel painting and
yes.
collectible things and so on. Is it possible that that maybe their prophecy is right, that we're heading now to somewhere where people don't want this stuff anymore?
I hope not. But I have to say that the death of painting has been predicted so many times and yet it's always proved wrong.
Yes.
Stupid Elam people and did away with so much of painting and life drawing and so on. They had to bite their own tongues now. I think it just will revive. But we have to just improve the environment, so people realize that they need the arts for a rich life.
Well, your recent recognition through the honours system is a signal that here is somebody who has dipped deeply and constantly in support of the arts. How else are we going to recruit the support of those who are able to deliver it, do you think?
I think that just getting that message across that it's not only necessary, but it's also rewarding to be involved with supporting cultural institutions or whatever, other institutions as well, but that you get a vicarious enjoyment out of it, even if you can't paint yourself. And the bread comes back on the water, or whatever the phrase is, because you've helped someone or some institution and they can suddenly give you a free concert or something. And if people can realize that it is worth the investment, not only because they should put something back into the community, but also because they will get some joy out of doing it, then if we can get that message across more, I think maybe some hope somewhere. I have been surprised what a lot of reaction I've had from the few statements I've made around the time of the investiture and so on. There must have been 100 or so people who've come up to me and said that they agreed and that we must try and encourage the succeeding generations to get more involved.
Have any of those capable of being a patron like yourself said that to you?
Yes, well, the point I make is that it's not, you don't have to put in a huge amount. If you have some surplus wealth, it put that in. Or if you have some surplus time, volunteer for these organisations, because a lot of them need a lot of volunteers for administration. And that both, it's not the scale, it's just the contribution that with, if there are plenty of people that do that, then it adds up to some really wealthy people putting in substantial amounts. But I don't know. Well, I've actually been talking to Creative New Zealand about how we can do something about promoting the idea of patronage somehow.
The Arts Foundation has now an award for patronage, but I suspect outside of a limited circle of people who are interested in the Arts Foundation and what it does, that probably largely goes unnoticed.
Yes. Yes, I think you need something wider than that.
Yes. James, one of the artists that has strongly represented in your collection, and I think we'd agree is probably one of the finest and yet least recognised of our artists, is Philip Trustum. You've had a long involvement in collecting Philip and friendship with Philip. Why Philip, and how has it come about?
he was an artist I became interested in decades ago, before I even knew him. I thought his work was so exciting, his handling of colour and form and his inventiveness and his the way he continued to evolve, didn't just stay in one successful niche. So when I got to know him, we set up a system where we kept paying a regular amount, and then each year we'd reconcile that with what he'd been producing. He sends me up lots of photographs of his work, and then each year I go down to Was Waimate, now Christchurch, and go through the work and pick some for the collection. I agree, I think he's one of the greatest artists, contemporary artists, and yet totally neglected to the point where no one has even done a book on him yet. So we're correcting that by doing a book that should come out in October, based on the works in the Wallace collection, which do span everything from 1960 to this last month. And that's going to be launched in conjunction with a retrospective of his work at the Parr Homestead. Hopefully that'll start to correct the lack of recognition, especially in the North Island.
But even in his own hometown?
Yes. I mean, Christchurch has never... He's had a few commissions there that matter, but the art gallery has never properly recognised him.
Why do you think?
I don't understand at all. I think the people worry that he is so prolific, but I find that exciting. He does produce a lot of work, but every phase is totally different from, well, evolves from previous ones. His present rugby works, which are upstairs at the Parr at the moment, are just so amazing. And totally different from anything I've ever seen before. So it has been one of the great excitements for me to each year to collect his latest work, and to then be in a position where we could do a whole book on it without having to go to other collections. We'd like to go to other collections, but that takes a long time. There is going to be a definitive book come out, I think, next year or the year after.
Mm-hmm.
But he deserves one now, especially as we're having a retrospective.
Mm. Well, I certainly want to thank you for your support of Philip. We were at art school together, and he was, even as a youth, a prodigious talent.
Yes.
Rudy Gopaz had Philip marked out, I think, as a sort of de facto son.
Yeah.
But, I mean, he was extraordinary in the art school, what he was doing at that time. And that energy and that creativity has never let up. It just continues.
No.
James, you've done so much across so many disciplines. You've built up this extraordinary collection. It's clear from what you haven't said as much as from what you've said that this energy is by no means spent, that there are other things going to happen. If you were to identify one thing that most excited you, that rewarded you most in what you've done, what would it be?
I think the partnership with the city, which has led to the Parr Homestead becoming the permanent home for the collection and the trust, because it has meant, as we touched on earlier, that the public finally has access to a lot more of the collection than it otherwise would have. And it has turned out to be amazingly successful, as we've already touched on. It's showing that people really do want to go and see that kind of the contemporary art in that kind of setting, and go to the cafe and wander around the park and so on. It's a destination. It has been a great... There's a great buzz all the time. We're open 6 days a week, and Monday is really rather dull, although our offices are out there, so you miss the buzz of all the people wandering around and seeing how they're obviously, a lot of them are really enjoying it. So that has brought into focus the whole idea of having a collection and putting it into a trust without access. And if it's just locked away, it's a bit of a waste of time, despite the 40-odd loans I mentioned.
I'm fascinated by what you just said, because once or twice I've been asked why I chose a career on the public side of the arts, and what is it that that motivated me to do so and continued to motivate me. And it was what you've just put your finger on, that interaction between the object or the event and people, the kind of excitement that comes from that. And it doesn't really matter whether it's a Tamari exhibition or Monet or a contemporary art exhibition or quite what it is. It's that engagement that people have with the activity that is so exciting.
Yes.
That's interesting coming from you, because you have been a collector, and collectors are often quite private about what they do. But in fact, the thing that's giving you most excitement at the moment now is the way in which that's engaging with people.
Yes. Yes, both there and Morrinsville in particular, both because they also include music. Yesterday we had the Jade Quartet with another quartet playing Mendelssohn Octet in open rehearsal for most of the day. Upstairs we're having a board meeting, but and then the public were just wandering around everywhere anyway, looking at the art awards. Morrinsville Gallery has gone on to the Chamber Music New Zealand circuit, and so we'll be having concerts there because the acoustics in the Wallace Gallery is so good. Morrinsville with the Chamber Music circuit.
Wonderful, wonderful. When we were talking about the private collections and where they might end up, one thought that was coursing through my mind was that, in a way, the major metropolitan centres are likely to be embarrassed with riches. But while that's happening, some of the smaller centres, and I'm talking significant size centres, but bigger than Morrinsville, really don't have very good collections. Now, you've been generous in moving things around, universities and other locations. Is this a possibility, reaching out, getting those collections out to the smaller centres?
Yes. We've been pressurised by some other towns now to come into some sort of partnership like the Morrinsville one. But apart from that, we're very happy to have some of the shows we curate go off to provincial galleries especially. A number of years ago, we sent the Wollastons around quite a few galleries, and I hope that we will do that with the Trustums at some point. And probably when we get to the 20 Ward Paramount winners, we'll send those off around the country a bit and so on. So where they don't have the resources or don't have their own collections to any extent, they can get access to ours. In a way, this is what happened with Waikato University when they went to build the Performing Arts Centre, which was highly successful. The then Vice Chancellor Brian Gould, an old friend, came to me and said, wanted a contribution. I said, look, Waikato University has no collection to speak of at all at that point. Let's design the centre so that you have good walls and lighting for art, visual art, and we'll give you a permanent revolving loan. And that's worked out as a great precedent from similar places. They go for one discipline and they get exposed to the art on these great walls. So it gives, that sort of thing gives more and more people access. The AUT Business School, which I think is one of the most successful one, has art on every floor all the way up. So all those budding businessmen are going to know something about contemporary art.
Maybe it'll rub off. In 92, you moved the collection into a trust, and that trust now has residencies, it has awards, it has the collection, it has these loans to various institutions. Sorry to end on a somber note, but what happens when there's no James Wallace anymore?
It is a concern in terms of who would succeed in choosing the art. The trust will go on forever because I've endowed it so that it does. It has a pretty big income because of taken out of the corporation to fund it. But that's perpetual. As long as the trustees that follow me are good at investing well and so on. But it is always a problem with succession. It, particularly, as I say, the, not so much the investments, because you can get some pretty astute people as we have as trustees, but the perpetuation of the collection in the way I see it, because I won't be there to do it. But it will go on.
James, congratulations on a life well lived and...
Still being lived.
Sorry?
Still being lived.
Good, and long may it do so.
Thank you very much.